copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
What we're going to consider now is the Old Testament and Jesus, the relationship between Jesus and the Old Testament. And I want to start with the way the New Testament views the Old Testament. This is what Jesus said to the two disciples after his resurrection on the road to Emmaus. He said, "O foolish ones and slow of heart to believe all that the prophets have spoken. Was it not necessary that the Christ should suffer these things and enter into his glory?" And beginning with Moses and the prophets, he interpreted to them in all the scriptures the things concerning himself. In other words, Jesus' view of the Old Testament is that it was essentially about him, which is rather remarkable because the Old Testament was written before Jesus was born. But I want to try and explore this subject in the way the New Testament handles it. And I want us to begin with Matthew's Gospel, because when Matthew begins, it begins with a series of quotations. There are 10 or possibly 11 of these fulfillment formulae in Matthew, and there's a whole series of them as the Gospel opens. For instance, it will quote Isaiah chapter 7, 14, that a virgin will conceive, and says, this is what happened, the narrative about Jesus happened, so that it might be fulfilled. That's the key word that occurs there. Or Jesus is taken by Joseph down to Egypt and brought up again. And then Matthew comments that this is to fulfill the scripture that says, out of Egypt I've called my son, quoting Hosea 11:1, which is where God says, I brought Israel out of Egypt. Again, it fulfills it. And then Herod goes and destroys all of the children nearby Jerusalem, by Bethlehem, and it says this was to fulfill again what was written in the prophet about Rachel weeping, a voice heard in Ramah, straight from Jeremiah. And then, rather bizarrely, it talks about how he goes to Nazareth and says this is to fulfill the word of the prophet that he will be called a Nazarene, and people debate whether that relates to being a Nazarite or whether it relates to somehow the word for the branch or offspring from the book of Isaiah, but it's not obvious and agreed what that would be. And then a couple of chapters later, the particular location in which Jesus ministers is in order to fulfill what was written about in Isaiah the prophet. So what we see is fulfill, fulfill, fulfill. That Matthew portrays Jesus as the one who comes along and fulfills what was in the Old Testament. And if you prefer to fulfill, perhaps the word just fill, because fulfill is just English with a double word fill, isn't it? Fill, fill. And we changed it into fulfill. It sounds a bit better. But the idea is, if you like, of a prophecy being something a bit like a vessel, which is waiting to receive something. It's waiting to receive, perhaps, liquid, and you fill it up. Or it's a jar waiting to receive its contents. The prophecy says, I'm incomplete. Just like that empty vessel says it wants something to come along and make it fulfill its purposes. I've just used that word again. Also in Matthew, we get a lot of this is that language. So for instance, when Herod calls his experts and asks them where the Christ will be born, then they tell him, it's going to be in Bethlehem, that's the birthplace of the king, quoting from Micah. Or we find that it will say that when John the Baptist comes along, it's really the voice of mentioned in Isaiah 40 verse 3, the voice in the wilderness. This is that. Another thing we get in Matthew is what we could call déjà vu. That's the English expression for something you've seen before. I think it's been borrowed by the French as well, and they use that. What we find is that when you come across Jesus, you actually think, I've seen this somewhere before. So the opening of Matthew is with a genealogy. And you remember that the genealogy is divided into to three sections. And it begins in verse 1 saying that Jesus is the son of David, the son of Abraham. Now, David, in numerical terms, to someone who knows Hebrew, if you spell it D-W-D, D is the fourth letter of the alphabet, W is the sixth letter, it adds up to 14. And, of course, David was the king, and this is all about Jesus the king. So there's a similarity there, and when the wise men, the magi, come looking, they're looking for a king born in Bethlehem. Oh, I know of a king before who was born in Bethlehem. It's David. So it looks like it's presenting Jesus rather like David. But then you find in chapter 2 that there is this narrative of Jesus being kept safe. And when he's kept safe, at the end of it, it says, those who sought... you can go back, the angel says to Joseph, because those who sought the life of the child are dead. Well, you think, actually, that's straight from Moses' life, isn't it? That Moses is able to go back because the one seeking his life was dead. And, of course, there's a real parallel between Herod and Pharaoh. Pharaoh killing the children of the Israelites, the boys, and Herod killing the boys. And so you actually see there's a whole nexus there of the way Jesus is presented like Moses. Jesus is also presented as being like Israel. After all, he comes out of Egypt just as Israel came out of Egypt. That's a theme you get again in chapter 3. For instance, we have this strange conversation between John the Baptist and Jesus, where Jesus says it is necessary for him to be baptized to fulfill all righteousness. It's not that he needs his sins washed away, but he needs to do something symbolic, as Israel, of course, had gone through the water or the dried up water. There is some parallel there that needs to be fulfilled. And we could also say there may be in chapter 3 something which presents Jesus as Elisha. Certainly he is the greater one who comes after Elijah. And you remember that the way John the Baptist is described as wearing this hairy clothing is just like we have in 2 Kings chapter 1 verse 8 for Elijah. Then we go to chapter 4. And we could say that it begins with a temptation narrative. And there you could say that Jesus is in the desert for 40 days. And we remember that Israel was in the desert for 40 years. We could say there's a bit of Adam similarity as well, because Adam took the food he shouldn't have done. And Jesus resists temptation in relation to food. But Jesus seems to be presented as Israel. And then you get to the chapter 5. And again, Jesus goes up a mountain, like Moses went up a mountain, and he proclaims his commandments, like Moses got the commandments from God. So what it seems is that we got an awful lot of deja vu. When you're seeing Jesus, and I'm not saying this is an exhaustive list, one of the key things is that all sorts of aspects of Jesus' life are reminiscent of things that you have seen before. There's a lot of... You know, not everything about Jesus is completely new. Oh, yes, the package is new, but there are all sorts of elements you think, wow, I've come across that before. And then, as Jesus gets to the Sermon on the Mountain, he says, "Do not think I've come to abolish the law or the prophets. I have not come to abolish them, but to fulfill them. For truly I say to you, heaven and earth will not pass away, not an iota, not a dot, pass from the law until all is accomplished." In other words, it's presenting the law and the prophets, the Old Testament, as being something which is prophetic. Point of order, not just the prophets in the Old Testament who predict things, but actually the structure as a whole is something which is waiting like a vessel to be filled up. It's pointing forward to something. Now, you might say, well, that's all very well, but isn't that the New Testament twisting the Old Testament? So the Old Testament is really one thing, and of course the New Testament writers come along and conveniently claim that the Old Testament is really all being fulfilled and it's all about Jesus. But we know the Old Testament isn't really like that. It's actually completely different. Does it really fit with the Old Testament? Well, I want to try and make the argument that it does, and that we can demonstrate this in an intuitive way. Now, intuition can have some real basis. So when we look, for instance, to infer whether something has been intelligently done, designed or not, there's a certain quantitative element to that. So if you see a few scratches on a rock, you might think that doesn't have to be intelligent. But when you have a carving that looks very much like a person, you say, okay, that's not going to happen by chance. So certain things can happen by the elements, certain things can happen by necessity, but quantitatively, because of course you can imagine there comes a point when you have enough an appearance of design that you say that is a design. Similarly, when someone's annoying you, you work out, are they deliberately trying to annoy me or are they not deliberately trying to annoy me? And if simply you're in a crowd and you brush by them, there isn't an evidence that they are deliberately trying to annoy you. So you dismiss the intelligent design hypothesis. On the other hand, if they are regularly doing this to you, and every time you pass them, you start saying, this is deliberate. So in other words, the question of design is one that has a quantitative element to it. And we are using this all of the time in our personal interactions as we judge characters and so on. It's something that actually we're very attuned to do. Now, I'd want to say that this is something that quantitatively, I'd want to say that the Bible presents itself as typological, the same sorts of things happening. Now, let's begin with Genesis 12. We have the story about how Abraham goes down into Egypt. And then, you remember, he's told Pharaoh that Sarah is his sister. Pharaoh gets together with Sarah. I think things may actually happen between Pharaoh and Sarah. This is, by the way, part of the proof that Sarah is barren. That the most potent guy on earth can't make more happen. You get it. And then Pharaoh is plagued. And it's very specifically that God plagues Pharaoh. The same, by the way, I don't think it happens every time it happens. So you've got the three wife-sister narratives, and the one in which things are most risque is the first. I'm not saying it actually everything happened. It actually draws a veil over that. But certainly by chapter 20 and then chapter 26 of Genesis, less is happening. But what we have, and you're meant to contrast those, and that's, by the way, prequel and sequel stuff going on here. But here we have a prequel to the great Exodus, which is going to happen in the book of Exodus, that we have Abraham or God's people going down to Egypt, Pharaoh doing what he shouldn't and getting plagued. Then, of course, we have the main event in Exodus. But then we also have something like this, where in Jeremiah 16 it will talk about, you're not going to talk about the Exodus from Egypt anymore. You're going to be talking about how God brought people back from exile. So we have, if you like, a second Exodus. But why stop with just two? Because after all, if we have in Matthew, it says that Jesus coming out of Egypt is like the original Exodus, then we have a third Exodus, and why not have a fourth, which is when Moses and Elijah appear to Jesus with Jesus at the Transfiguration, and they speak about his Exodus, which he's going to accomplish in his death. And if you want to have a fifth, you might look in the book of Revelation. So in other words, the point is that you have Exodus is happening again and again and again. And this is, to put it in the words of the great American commentator Yogi Berra, it's like deja vu all over again. And I want to argue that these sorts of patterns that we have between Jesus and the Old Testament are not peripheral. They're actually very central themes. If we look at main storyline that we have within the Old Testament, something like the promised seed, this is something which is already there by the third chapter of the Bible, and that is thematized in the books. So it's a very major thing, and we could say that Jesus' correlation with that fits. The promised only son is at such a climactic point in the Bible, and of course, Isaac is offered on the same mountain as Jesus. The oppression and rescue narrative of the Old Testament, again, something centrally fits with the themes of Jesus. The separation from God, which is a theme in the Bible from Genesis 3 onwards as people sin, and then God makes his presence known in the tabernacle where he is specially there in the Holy of Holies in the Bible. These are big themes that take up lots of chapters and are things that correlate very much with Jesus' own life, presentation in Matthew as being God with us. Whether it's priests, judges, kings and prophets take up vast numbers of chapters, they all are things that fit with Jesus. Now, what I want to say is that they also correlate when we look at the categories that the Jesus story in the New Testament seems to fit with. They are all very central to the Bible. So the category of sin, which is very important in the New Testament narrative, is there, which is already there by the third chapter of the Bible. The argument of death for sin, again, something really central to Jesus' mission as portrayed in the New Testament, is something that is very early on in the Bible. The idea of sacrifice, already there at least by chapter 4. The idea of the importance of blood is a major theme element, one of the main points that's made just after the flood itself. Jesus conveniently died at Passover time, which, if it was just a coincidence, was the best time of the year to fulfill so much symbolism, because it was the time of the Jews celebrated their greatest deliverance, the central part, therefore, of the book. So what I'm saying is the way that Jesus correlates with the Old Testament is not peripheral. It's not odd phrases taken from here and there. It's actually the very central themes that we have of Jesus' life fit with the very central themes we have in the Old Testament. But we also have biographical correlations. I want to have a look at a couple of those. One is the figure of Samson. How does the figure of Samson fit with Jesus? Well, you remember Samson was quite a lad. And one of the things we're told is that the Nazarite, and Samson's supposed to be a Nazarite, is not meant to touch the dead things, not to touch the fruit of the vine. So the very first scene we have with Samson is he is going through a vineyard, and he sees a lion, he kills it, therefore the lion is dead. He then gets food from its body a little bit later, touching dead bodies. He gets the fresh jawbone of an ass from the donkey, a fresh jawbone showing it is, again, unclean. He is going to feasts, implying wine. He loves a woman from the valley of Sorek, which is a type of grape, whose name is Delilah, hanging down. Everything about this man is breaking the law again and again. And you say, well, he really seems to get away with it. No. Watch this. Because what happens in the Samson story is that you have to watch Samson's eyes. You see, he went down to Timnah and he saw one of the daughters of the Philistines. He said to his father, get her for me. She's right in my eyes. Or again, he saw a prostitute. Well, what happens to Samson's eyes? Of course, they get gouged out. So it's not that you can get away with sinning like this and nothing will happen. So how on earth can that figure be a picture of Christ? Well, there are many similarities between Samson's biography and Christ. The angelic announcement of birth, that he's a saviour, the Spirit of God comes on him. He achieves his greatest salvation by dying, and his position at death, of course, like this, by the way, calling out for vengeance. He thirsts, a very significant part of the narrative. He's betrayed for money. All sorts of similarities. But what we could say is there are also these contrasts. One deliberately saves. Christ deliberately saves. Samson accidentally saves. He's actually trying to kill as many people as he can to get revenge. He happens to save Israel doing that. It says in Isaiah that the true Messiah will not judge by what his eyes see, whereas Samson follows his eyes. He dies calling for people to be... Christ dies calling for people to be forgiven. Samson, of course, dies crying for revenge. Christ brought the most life through his death. Samson brought the most death through his death. One was obedient to God, one was disobedient, one was self-sacrificing, and there's only one thing that motivates Samson, and that is absolute self-interest. It's a whole thing about how revenge goes from one level to another. So what I want to say is, yes, it's a beautiful picture of Christ by contrast. So you have all sorts of things where it aligns and, yes, points to Christ, and then we have the things that are absolutely flipped. Elisha, similarly, so many similarities between them, one at the level of name, the same elements, Shah, salvation, and Yeshua, for Jesus, is there. And you can look at the names, preceded by an Elijah figure, greater than the one before them, cleansing lepers, multiplying food, raising dead sons, make something float, greedy disciple, people flee from their tomb, all sorts of things like that. Where we can say, yes, there are lots of similarities, they've been pointed out before. And what I'd want to say is, I think the whole Old Testament is basically about Christ. And the way we're meant to look at it is like this. People asked earlier about Jesus's repeated teaching. The one thing that he says five times, five different passages, are the one who has more will be given, and he will have in abundance. From the one who does not have, even what he has will be taken away. Now, two of these texts are different because they're in parables about money, but three of them are very clearly about this, how you hear. And the more you hear, the more you will be given, the more you, if you like, accept. And I'd want to say that the way you find out about the Bible being about Jesus is the more you accept it's about Jesus, the more you will be shown it's about Jesus. And I think that fits very much with this theme. So thank you very much for listening.